Disc 23.
Chapter 71. 5 days after the death of Raffles, Mr. Bambridge was standing at his leisure under the large archway leading into the yard of the Green Dragon. He was not fond of solitary contemplation, but he had only just come out of the house, and any human figure standing at ease under the archway in the early afternoon was as certain to attract companionship as a pigeon which has found something worth pecking at. In this case there was no material object to feed upon, but the eye of reason saw a probability of mental sustenance in the shape of gossip. Mr. Hopkins, the meek-mannered draper opposite, was the first to act on this inward vision, being the more ambitious of a little masculine talk because his customers were chiefly women. Mr. Bambridge was rather curt to the draper, feeling that Hopkins was of course glad to talk to him, but that he was not going to waste much of his talk on Hopkins. Soon, however, there was a small cluster of more important listeners, who were either deposited from the passers-by, or had sauntered to the spot expressly to see if there were anything going on at the Green Dragon, and Mr. Bambridge was finding it worth his while to say many impressive things about the fine studs he had been seeing, and the purchases he had made on a journey in the north from which he had just returned. Gentlemen present were assured that when they could show him anything to cut out a blood mare, a bay rising four, which was to be seen at Doncaster if they chose to go and look at it, Mr. Bambridge would gratify them by being shot from here to Hereford. Also a pair of blacks, which he was going to put into the break, recalled vividly to his mind a pair which he had sold to Faulkner in 19 for 100 guineas, and which Faulkner had sold for 160 2 months later. Any agent who could disprove this statement, being offered the privilege of calling Mr. Bambridge by a very ugly name until the exercise made his throat dry. When the discourse was at this point of animation, came up Mr. Frank Hawley. He was not a man to compromise his dignity by lounging at the Green Dragon, but happening to pass along the High Street, and seeing Bambridge on the other side, he took some of his long strides to ask the horse-dealer whether he had found the first-rate gig horse which he had engaged to look for. Mr. Hawley was requested to wait until he had seen a grey selected at Bilkley. If that did not meet his wishes to a hare, Bambridge did not know a horse when he saw it, which seemed to be the highest conceivable unlikelihood. Mr. Hawley, standing with his back to the street, was fixing a time for looking at the grey and seeing it tried, when a horseman passed slowly by. "Bulstrode," said two or three voices at once, in a low tone, one of them, which was the draper's, respectfully fixing the mister, but nobody having more intention in this interjectional naming than if they had said the Riverston coach when that vehicle appeared in the distance. Mr. Hawley gave a careless glance round at Bulstrode's back, but as Bambridge's eyes followed it, he made a sarcastic grimace. "By jingo, that reminds me," he began, lowering his voice a little. "I picked up something else at Bilkley besides your gig horse, Mr. Hawley. I picked up a fine story about Bulstrode. Do you know how he came by his fortune? Any gentleman wanting a bit of curious information, I can give it him free of expense. If everybody got their desserts, Bulstrode might have had to say his prayers at Botany Bay." "What do you mean?" said Mr. Hawley, thrusting his hands into his pockets and pushing a little forward under the archway. If Bulstrode should turn out to be a rascal, Frank Hawley had a prophetic soul. "I had it from a party who was an old chum of Bulstrode's. I'll tell you where I first picked him up," said Bambridge, with a sudden gesture of his forefinger. "He was at Larcher's sale, but I knew nothing of him then. He slipped through my fingers. Was after Bulstrode, no doubt. He tells me he can tap Bulstrode to any amount, knows all his secrets. However, he blabbed to me at Bilkley. He takes a stiff glass. Damn me if I think he meant to turn king's evidence, but he's that sort of bragging fellow. The bragging runs over hedge and ditch with him till he'd brag of a spavin as if it had fetched money. A man should know when to pull up." Mr. Bambridge made this remark with an air of disgust, satisfied that his own bragging showed a fine sense of the marketable.
"What's the man's name? Where can he be found?" said Mr. Hawley. "As to where he is to be found, I left him to it at the Saracen's Head, but his name is Raffles."
"Raffles!" exclaimed Mr. Hopkins. "I furnished his funeral yesterday. He was buried at Lowick. Mr. Bulstrode followed him. A very decent funeral." There was a strong sensation among the listeners. Mr. Bambridge gave an ejaculation in which brimstone was the mildest word, and Mr. Hawley, knitting his brows and bending his head forward, exclaimed, "What? Where did the man die?"
"At Stone Court," said the draper. "The housekeeper said he was a relation of the master's. He came there ill on Friday."
"Why, it was on Wednesday. I took a glass with him," interposed Bambridge. "Did any doctor attend him?" said Mr. Hawley.
"Yes, Mr. Lydgate. Mr. Bulstrode sat up with him one night. He died the third morning."
"Go on, Bambridge," said Mr. Hawley insistently. "What did this fellow say about Bulstrode?"
The group had already become larger, the town clerk's presence being a guarantee that something worth listening to was going on there, and Mr. Bambridge delivered his narrative in the hearing of seven. It was mainly what we know, including the fact about Will Ladislaw, with some local colour and circumstance added. It was what Bulstrode had dreaded the betrayal of, and hoped to have buried forever with the corpse of Raffles. It was that haunting ghost of his earlier life, which as he rode past the archway of the Green Dragon, he was trusting that Providence had delivered him from. Yes, Providence. He had not confessed to himself yet that he had done anything in the way of contrivance to this end. He had accepted what seemed to have been offered. It was impossible to prove that he had done anything which hastened the departure of that man's soul. But this gossip about Bulstrode spread through Middlemarch like the smell of fire. Mr. Frank Hawley followed up his information by sending a clerk whom he could trust to Stone Court on a pretext of inquiring about Hay, but really to gather all that could be learned about Raffles and his illness from Mrs. Abel. In this way it came to his knowledge that Mr. Garth had carried the man to Stone Court in his gig, and Mr. Hawley, in consequence, took an opportunity of seeing Caleb, calling at his office to ask whether he had time to undertake an arbitration, if it were required, and then asking him incidentally about Raffles. Caleb was betrayed into no word injurious to Bulstrode, beyond the fact which he was forced to admit, that he had given up acting for him within the last week. Mr. Hawley drew his inferences, and feeling convinced that Raffles had told his story to Garth, and that Garth had given up Bulstrode's affairs in consequence, said so a few hours later to Mr. Toller. The statement was passed on, until it had quite lost the stamp of an inference and was taken as information coming straight from Garth, so that even a diligent historian might have concluded Caleb to be the chief publisher of Bulstrode's misdemeanours. Mr. Hawley was not slow to perceive that there was no handle for the law, either in the revelations made by Raffles or in the circumstances of his death. He had himself ridden to Lowick Village that he might look at the register and talk over the whole matter with Mr. Fairbrother, who was not more surprised than the lawyer that an ugly secret should have come to light about Bulstrode, though he had always had justice enough in him to hinder his antipathy from turning into conclusions. But while they were talking, another combination was silently going forward in Mr. Fairbrother's mind, which foreshadowed what was soon to be loudly spoken of in Middlemarch as a necessary putting of two and two together. With the reasons which kept Bulstrode in dread of Raffles, there flashed the thought that the dread might have something to do with his munificence towards his medical man. And though he resisted the suggestion that it had been consciously accepted in any way as a bribe, he had a foreboding that this complication of things might be of malignant effect on Lydgate's reputation. He perceived that Mr. Hawley knew nothing at present of the sudden relief from debt, and he himself was careful to glide away from all approaches towards the subject. "Well," he said with a deep breath, wanting to wind up the illimitable discussion of what might have been, though nothing could be legally proven, "it is a strange story. So our mercurial Ladislaw has a queer genealogy. A high-spirited young lady and a musical Polish patriot made a likely enough stock for him to spring from, but I should never have suspected a grafting of the Jew pawnbroker. However, there's no knowing what a mixture will turn out beforehand. Some sorts of dirt serve to clarify."
"It's just what I should have expected," said Mr. Hawley, mounting his horse. "Any cursed alien blood, Jew, Corsican or gypsy?"
"I know he's one of your black sheep, Hawley, but he is really a disinterested, unworldly fellow," said Mr. Fairbrother, smiling.
"Aye, aye, that is your Whiggish twist," said Mr. Hawley,
who had been in the habit of saying apologetically that Fairbrother was such a damned pleasant, good-hearted fellow, you would mistake him for a Tory. Mr. Hawley rode home, without thinking of Lydgate's attendance on Raffles, in any other light than as a piece of evidence on the side of Bulstrode. But the news that Lydgate had all at once become able not only to get rid of the execution in his house, but to pay all his debts in Middlemarch, was spreading fast, gathering round it conjectures and comments which gave it new body and impetus, and soon filling the ears of other persons besides Mr. Hawley, who were not slow to see a significant relation between this sudden command of money and Bulstrode's desire to stifle the scandal of Raffles. That the money came from Bulstrode would infallibly have been guessed, even if there had been no direct evidence of it, for it had beforehand entered into the gossip about Lydgate's affairs that neither his father-in-law nor his own family would do anything for him, and direct evidence was furnished not only by a clerk at the bank, but by innocent Mrs. Bulstrode herself, who mentioned the loan to Mrs. Plimdale, who mentioned it to her daughter-in-law of the House of Toller, who mentioned it generally. The business was felt to be so public and important that it required dinners to feed it, and many invitations were just then issued and accepted on the strength of this scandal concerning Bulstrode and Lydgate. Wives, widows, and single ladies took their work and went out to tea oftener than usual, and all public conviviality from the Green Dragon to Dollops gathered a zest which could not be won from the question whether the Lords would throw out the Reform Bill. For hardly anybody doubted that some scandalous reason or other was at the bottom of Bulstrode's liberality to Lydgate. Mr. Hawley, indeed, in the first instance, invited a select party, including the two physicians, with Mr. Toller and Mr. Wrench, expressly to hold a close discussion as to the probabilities of Raffles' illness, reciting to them all the particulars which had been gathered from Mrs. Abel in connection with Lydgate's certificate, that the death was due to delirium tremens. And the medical gentlemen, who all stood undisturbedly on the old paths in relation to this disease, declared that they could see nothing in these particulars which could be transformed into a positive ground of suspicion. But the moral grounds of suspicion remained. The strong motives Bulstrode clearly had for wishing to be rid of Raffles, and the fact that at this critical moment he had given Lydgate the help which he must for some time have known the need for, the disposition, moreover, to believe that Bulstrode would be unscrupulous, and the absence of any indisposition to believe that Lydgate might be as easily bribed as other haughty-minded men when they have found themselves in want of money. Even if the money had been given merely to make him hold his tongue about the scandal of Bulstrode's earlier life, the fact threw an odious light on Lydgate, who had long been sneered at as making himself subservient to the banker for the sake of working himself into predominance and discrediting the older members of his profession. Hence, in spite of the negative as to any direct sign of guilt in relation to the death at Stone Court, Mr. Hawley's select party broke up with the sense that the affair had an ugly look. But this vague conviction of indeterminable guilt, which was enough to keep up much head-shaking and biting innuendo, even among substantial professional seniors, had for the general mind all the superior power of mystery over fact. Everybody liked better to conjecture how the thing was than simply to know it. For conjecture soon became more confident than knowledge, and had a more liberal allowance for the incompatible. Even the more definite scandal concerning Bulstrode's earlier life was for some minds melted into the mass of mystery as so much lively metal to be poured out in dialogue, and to take such fantastic shapes as heaven pleased. This was the tone of thought chiefly sanctioned by Mrs. Dollop, the spirited landlady of the Tankard in Slaughter Lane, who had often to resist the shallow pragmatism of customers disposed to think that their reports from the outer world were of equal force with what had come up in her mind. How it had been brought to her she didn't know, but it was there before her as if it had been scored with the chalk on the chimney-board. As Bulstrode should say, his inside was that black as if the hairs of his head knowed the thoughts of his heart, he'd tear him up by the roots. "That's odd," said Mr. Limp, a meditative shoemaker with weak eyes and a piping voice. "Why, I read in the Trumpet that was what the Duke of Wellington said when he turned his coat and went over to the Romans."
"Very like," said Mrs. Dollop. "If one rascal said it, it's more reason why another should.
But hypocritus he's been, and holding things with that high hand as there was no parson in the country good enough for him, he was forced to take old Harry into his council, and old Harry's been too many for him.
Aye, aye, he's accomplished, you can't send out of the country, said Mr. Crabb, the glazier, who gathered much news and groped among it dimly.
But by what I can make out, there's them says Bulstrode was for running away for fear of being found out before now.
"'He'll be drove away, whether or no,' said Mr. Dill the barber, who had just dropped in. "'I shaved Fletcher, Hawley's clerk, this morning. He's got a bad finger. "'And he says they're all of one mind to get rid of Bulstrode. "'Mr. Thesiger is turned against him and wants him out of the parish.
"'And there's gentlemen in this town, says they'd as soon dine with a fellow from the Hulks. "'And a deal sooner I would,' says Fletcher, "'for what's more against one's stomach "'than a man coming and making himself bad company with his religion "'and giving out as the Ten Commandments are not enough for him, "'and all the while he's worse than half the men at the treadmill. "'Fletcher said so himself.'
"'It'll be a bad thing for the town, though, "'if Bulstrode's money goes out of it,' said Mr. Limp, quaveringly.
"'Ah, there's bitter folk spend their money worse,' said a firm-voiced dyer,
whose crimson hands looked out of keeping with his good-natured face.
"'But he won't keep his money by what I can make out,' said the glazier. "'Don't they say as there's somebody can strip it off him? "'By what I can understand, they could take every penny off him if they went to Loring.'
"'No such thing,' said the barber,
who felt himself a little above his company at Dollops, but liked it none the worse.
"'Fletcher says it's no such thing. "'He says they might prove over and over again "'whose child this young Ladislaw was, "'and they'd do no more than if they proved I came out of the fens. "'He couldn't touch a penny.'
"'Look you there now,' said Mrs. Dollop indignantly. "'I thank the Lord he took my children to himself "'if that's all the law can do for the motherless. "'Then by that, it's a no use who your father and mother is.'
But as to listening to what one lawyer says without asking another, I wonder at a man of your cleverness, Mr. Dill. It's well known there's always two sides. If no more, else who'd go to law, I should like to know. It's a poor tale with all the law as there is up and down if it's no use proving whose child you are. Fletcher may say that if he likes, but I say don't Fletcher me.
Mr. Dill affected to laugh in a complimentary way at Mrs. Dollop, as a woman who was more than a match for the lawyers, being disposed to submit to much twitting from a landlady who had a long score against him.
"'If they come to Loring, and it's all true as folks say, there's more to be looked to nor money,' said the glazier. "'There's this poor creature as is dead and gone.
"'By what I can make out, he'd seen the day when he was a deal finer gentleman nor Bulstrode.'
"'Finer gentleman, I'll warrant him,' said Mrs. Dollop, "'and a far personabler man, by what I can hear. "'As I said when Mr. Baldwin the tax-gatherer comes in, "'a-standing where you sit, and says Bulstrode got all his money "'as he brought into this town by thieving and swindling, "'I said, you don't make me no wiser, Mr. Baldwin. "'It set my blood a-creeping to look at him "'ever since here he came into Slaughter Lane "'a-wanting to buy the house over my head.' "'Folks, don't look the colour of the dough-tub "'and stare at you as if they wanted to see into your backbone for nothink. "'That was what I said, and Mr. Baldwin can bear me witness.'
"'And in the rights of it, too,' said Mr. Crabb. "'For by what I can make out, this Raffles, as they call him, "'was a lusty, fresh-coloured man as you'd wish to see, "'and the best of company, though dead he lies in Lowick Churchyard, sure enough. "'And by what I can understand, there's them knows more than they should know about how he got there.
"'I'll believe you,' said Mrs. Dollop, with a touch of scorn at Mr. Crabb's apparent dimness. "'When a man's been ticed to a lone house, and there's them can pay for hospitals and nurses for half the countryside, choose to be sitters up night and day, and nobody to come near but a doctor as is known to stick at nothing, and as poor as he can hang together. "'And after that so flushed a money as he can pay off Mr. Biles the butcher, "'as his bill has been running on for the best of joints "'since last Michaelmas was a twelvemonth. "'I don't want anybody to come and tell me, "'as there's been more going on nor the prayer book's got a service for. "'I don't want to stand winking and blinking and thinking.'
Mrs. Dollop looked round with the air of a landlady accustomed to dominate her company. There was a chorus of adhesion from the more courageous, but Mr. Limp, after taking a draught, placed his flat hands together and pressed them hard between his knees, looking down at them with blear-eyed contemplation, as if the scorching power of Mrs. Dollop's speech had quite dried up and nullified his wits until they could be brought round again by further moisture.
"Why shouldn't they dig the man up and have the crowner?" said the dyer. "It's been done many and many's the time. If there's been foul play, they might find it out."
"Not they, Mr. Jonas," said Mrs. Dollop emphatically. "I know what doctors are. They're a deal too cunning to be found out. And this Dr. Lydgate, that's been for cutting up everybody before the breath was well out of their body, it's plain enough what use he wanted to make of looking into respectable people's insides. He knows drugs, you may be sure, as you can neither smell nor see, neither before they're swallowed nor after. Why, I've seen drops myself ordered by Dr. Gambit, as is our club doctor and a good character, and has brought more live children into the world nor ever another in Middlemarch. I say I've seen drops myself as made no difference whether they was in the glass or out, and yet have griped you the next day. So I'll leave your own sense to judge."
"Don't tell me. All I say is, it's a mercy they didn't take this Dr. Lydgate onto our club. There's many a mother's child might have rued it."
The heads of this discussion at Dollop's had been the common theme among all classes in the town, had been carried to Lowick Parsonage on one side and to Tipton Grange on the other, had come fully to the ears of the Vincey family, and had been discussed with sad reference to poor Harriet by all Mrs. Bulstrode's friends, before Lydgate knew distinctly why people were looking strangely at him, and before Bulstrode himself suspected the betrayal of his secrets. He had not been accustomed to very cordial relations with his neighbours, and hence he could not miss the signs of cordiality. Moreover, he had been taking journeys on business of various kinds, having now made up his mind that he need not quit Middlemarch, and feeling able consequently to determine on matters which he had before left in suspense.
"We will make a journey to Cheltenham in the course of a month or two," he had said to his wife. "There are great spiritual advantages to be had in that town, along with the air and the waters, and 6 weeks there will be eminently refreshing to us."
He really believed in the spiritual advantages, and meant that his life henceforth should be the more devoted because of those later sins which he represented to himself as hypothetic, praying hypothetically for their pardon, "if I have herein transgressed." As to the hospital, he avoided saying anything further to Lydgate, fearing to manifest a too sudden change of plans immediately on the death of Raffles. In his secret soul, he believed that Lydgate suspected his orders to have been intentionally disobeyed, and suspecting this, he must also suspect a motive. But nothing had been betrayed to him as to the history of Raffles, and Bulstrode was anxious not to do anything which would give emphasis to his undefined suspicions. As to any certainty that a particular method of treatment would either save or kill, Lydgate himself was constantly arguing against such dogmatism. He had no right to speak, and he had every motive for being silent. Hence, Bulstrode felt himself providentially secured. The only incident he had strongly winced under had been an occasional encounter with Caleb Garth, who, however, had raised his hat with mild gravity. Meanwhile, on the part of the principal townsmen, a strong determination was growing against him. A meeting was to be held in the town hall on a sanitary question, which had risen into pressing importance by the occurrence of a cholera case in the town. Since the Act of Parliament, which had been hurriedly passed, authorising assessments for sanitary measures, there had been a board for the superintendence of such measures appointed in Middlemarch, and much cleansing and preparation had been concurred in by Whigs and Tories. The question now was whether a piece of ground outside the town should be secured as a burial ground by means of assessment or by private subscription. The meeting was to be open, and almost everybody of importance in the town was expected to be there. Mr. Bulstrode was a member of the board, and just before 12 o'clock he started from the bank with the intention of urging the plan of private subscription. Under the hesitation of his projects, he had for some time kept himself in the background, and he felt that he should this morning resume his old position as a man of action and influence in the public affairs of the town where he expected to end his days. Among the various persons going in the same direction, he saw Lydgate. They joined, talked over the object of the meeting, and entered it together. It seemed that everybody of mark had been earlier than they, but there were still spaces left near the head of the large central table, and they made their way thither. Mr. Fairbrother sat opposite, not far from Mr. Hawley. All the medical men were there. Mr. Thesiger was in the chair, and Mr. Brooke of Tipton was on his right hand. Lydgate noticed a peculiar interchange of glances when he and Bulstrode took their seats. After the business had been fully opened by the chairman, who pointed out the advantages of purchasing by subscription a piece of ground large enough to be ultimately used as a general cemetery, Mr. Bulstrode, whose rather high-pitched but subdued and fluent voice the town was used to at meetings of this sort, rose and asked leave to deliver his opinion. Lydgate could see again the peculiar interchange of glances before Mr. Hawley started up and said in his firm, resonant voice, "Mr. Chairman, I request that before anyone delivers his opinion on this point, I may be permitted to speak on a question of public feeling, which not only by myself, but by many gentlemen present, is regarded as preliminary." Mr. Hawley's mode of speech, even when public decorums repressed his awful language, was formidable in its curtness and self-possession. Mr. Thesiger sanctioned the request. Mr. Bulstrode sat down, and Mr. Hawley continued. "In what I have to say, Mr. Chairman, I am not speaking simply on my own behalf. I am speaking with the concurrence and at the express request of no fewer than 8 of my fellow townsmen, who are immediately around us. It is our united sentiment that Mr. Bulstrode should be called upon, and I do now call upon him, to resign public positions which he holds not simply as a taxpayer, but as a gentleman among gentlemen. There are practices and there are acts which, owing to circumstances, the law cannot visit, though they may be worse than many things which are legally punishable. Honest men and gentlemen, if they don't want the company of people who perpetrate such acts, have got to defend themselves as they best can. And that is what I, and the friends whom I may call my clients in this affair, are determined to do. I don't say that Mr. Bulstrode has been guilty of shameful acts, but I call upon him either publicly to deny and confute the scandalous statements made against him by a man now dead and who died in his house, the statement that he was for many years engaged in nefarious practices and that he won his fortune by dishonest procedures, or else to withdraw from positions which could only have been allowed him as a gentleman among gentlemen." All eyes in the room were turned on Mr. Bulstrode, who since the first mention of his name had been going through a crisis of feeling almost too violent for his delicate frame to support. Lydgate, who himself was undergoing a shock as from the terrible practical interpretation of some faint augury, felt nevertheless that his own movement of resentful hatred was checked by that instinct of the healer which thinks first of bringing rescue or relief to the sufferer, when he looked at the shrunken misery of Bulstrode's livid face. The quick vision that his life was after all a failure, that he was a dishonoured man and must quail before the glance of those towards whom he had habitually assumed the attitude of a reprover, that God had disowned him before men and left him unscreened to the triumphant scorn of those who were glad to have their hatred justified, the sense of utter futility in that equivocation with his conscience in dealing with the life of his accomplice, an equivocation which now turned venomously upon him with the full-grown fang of a discovered lie. All this rushed through him like the agony of terror which fails to kill and leaves the ears still open to the returning wave of execration. The sudden sense of exposure, after the re-established sense of safety, came not to the coarse organization of a criminal, but to the susceptible nerve of a man whose intensest being lay in such mastery and predominance as the conditions of his life had shaped for him. But in that intense being lay the strength of reaction. Through all his bodily infirmity, there ran a tenacious nerve of ambitious, self-preserving will, which had continually leaped out like a flame, scattering all doctrinal fears, and which, even while he sat an object of compassion for the merciful, was beginning to stir and glow under his ashy paleness. Before the last words were out of Mr. Hawley's mouth, Bulstrode felt that he should answer, and that his answer would be a retort. He dared not get up and say, "I am not guilty, the whole story is false." Even if he had dared this, it would have seemed to him, under his present keen sense of betrayal, as vain as to pull for covering to his nakedness a frail rag which would rend at every little strain. For a few moments there was total silence, while every man in the room was looking at Bulstrode. He sat perfectly still, leaning hard against the back of his chair. He could not venture to rise, and when he began to speak, he pressed his hands upon the seat on each side of him. But his voice was perfectly audible, though hoarser than usual, and his words were distinctly pronounced, though he paused between each sentence, as if short of breath. He said, turning first towards Mr. Thesiger, and then looking at Mr. Hawley, "I protest before you, sir, as a Christian minister, against the sanction of proceedings towards me, which are dictated by virulent hatred. Those who are hostile to me are glad to believe any libel uttered by a loose tongue against me, and their consciences become strict against me. Say that the evil speaking, of which I am to be made the victim, accuses me of malpractices." Here Bulstrode's voice rose and took on a more biting accent, till it seemed a low cry. "Who shall be my accuser? Not men whose own lives are unchristian, nay, scandalous. Not men who themselves use low instruments to carry out their ends, whose profession is a tissue of chicanery, who have been spending their income on their own sensual enjoyments, while I have been devoting mine to advance the best objects with regard to this life and the next." After the word chicanery, there was a growing noise, half of murmurs and half of hisses, while four persons started up at once, Mr. Hawley, Mr. Toller, Mr. Chicherley, and Mr. Hackbutt. But Mr. Hawley's outburst was instantaneous and left the others behind in silence.
"If you mean me, sir, I call upon you and everyone else to the inspection of my professional life. As to Christian or unchristian, I repudiate your canting, palavering Christianity. And as to the way in which I spend my income, it is not my principle to maintain thieves and cheat offspring of their due inheritance in order to support religion and set myself up as a saintly killjoy. I affect no niceness of conscience. I have not found any nice standards necessary yet to measure your actions by, sir. And I again call upon you to enter into satisfactory explanations concerning the scandals against you, or else to withdraw from posts in which we, at any rate, decline you as a colleague. I say, sir, we decline to cooperate with a man whose character is not cleared from infamous lights cast upon it, not only by reports, but by recent actions."
"Allow me, Mr. Hawley," said the chairman, and Mr. Hawley, still fuming, bowed half impatiently, and sat down with his hands thrust deep in his pockets. "Mr. Bulstrode, it is not desirable, I think, to prolong the present discussion," said Mr. Thesiger, turning to the pallid, trembling man. "I must so far concur with what has fallen from Mr. Hawley in expression of a general feeling, as to think it due to your Christian profession that you should clear yourself, if possible, from unhappy aspersions. I, for my part, should be willing to give you full opportunity and hearing. But I must say that your present attitude is painfully inconsistent with those principles which you have sought to identify yourself with, and for the honour of which I am bound to care. I recommend you at present, as your clergyman and one who hopes for your reinstatement in respect, to quit the room and avoid further hindrance to business." Bulstrode, after a moment's hesitation, took his hat from the floor and slowly rose. But he grasped the corner of the chair so totteringly that Lydgate felt sure there was not strength enough in him to walk away without support. What could he do? He could not see a man sink close to him for want of help. He rose and gave his arm to Bulstrode, and in that way led him out of the room. Yet this act, which might have been one of gentle duty and pure compassion, was at this moment unspeakably bitter to him. It seemed as if he were putting his sign manual to that association of himself with Bulstrode, of which he now saw the full meaning as it must have presented itself to other minds. He now felt the conviction that this man who was leaning tremblingly on his arm had given him the £1,000 as a bribe, and that somehow the treatment of Raffles had been tampered with from an evil motive. The inferences were closely linked enough. The town knew of the loan, believed it to be a bribe, and believed that he took it as a bribe. Poor Lydgate, his mind struggling under the terrible clutch of this revelation, was all the while morally forced to take Mr. Bulstrode to the bank, send a man off for his carriage, and wait to accompany him home. Meanwhile, the business of the meeting was dispatched, and fringed off into eager discussion among various groups concerning this affair of Bulstrode and Lydgate. Mr. Brooke, who had before heard only imperfect hints of it, and was very uneasy that he had gone a little too far in countenancing Bulstrode, now got himself fully informed, and felt some benevolent sadness in talking to Mr. Fairbrother about the ugly light in which Lydgate had come to be regarded. Mr. Fairbrother was going to walk back to Lowick. "Step into my carriage," said Mr. Brooke. "I am going round to see Mrs. Casaubon. She was to come back from Yorkshire last night. She will like to see me, you know." So they drove along, Mr. Brooke chatting with good-natured hope that there had not really been anything black in Lydgate's behaviour, a young fellow whom he had seen to be quite above the common mark when he brought a letter from his uncle, Sir Godwin. Mr. Fairbrother said little. He was deeply mournful. With a keen perception of human weakness, he could not be confident that under the pressure of humiliating needs, Lydgate had not fallen below himself. When the carriage drove up to the gate of the manor, Dorothea was out on the gravel and came to greet them. "Well, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, "we have just come from a meeting, a sanitary meeting, you know."
"Was Mr. Lydgate there?" said Dorothea, who looked full of health and animation, and stood with her head bare under the gleaming April lights. "I want to see him and have a great consultation with him about the hospital. I have engaged with Mr. Bulstrode to do so."
"Oh, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, "we have been hearing bad news. Bad news, you know."
They walked through the garden towards the churchyard gate, Mr. Fairbrother wanting to go on to the parsonage, and Dorothea heard the whole sad story. She listened with deep interest, and begged to hear twice over the facts and impressions concerning Lydgate. After a short silence, pausing at the churchyard gate and addressing Mr. Fairbrother, she said energetically, "You don't believe that Mr. Lydgate is guilty of anything base? I will not believe it. Let us find out the truth and clear him."
Book 8. Sunset and Sunrise. Chapter 72. Dorothea's impetuous generosity, which would have leaped at once to the vindication of Lydgate from the suspicion of having accepted money as a bribe, underwent a melancholy check when she came to consider all the circumstances of the case by the light of Mr. Fairbrother's experience. "It is a delicate matter to touch," he said. "How can we begin to inquire into it? It must be either publicly by setting the magistrate and coroner to work, or privately by questioning Lydgate. As to the first proceeding, there is no solid ground to go upon, else Hawley would have adopted it. And as to opening the subject with Lydgate, I confess I should shrink from it. He would probably take it as a deadly insult. I have more than once experienced the difficulty of speaking to him on personal matters. And one should know the truth about his conduct beforehand to feel very confident of a good result."
"I feel convinced that his conduct has not been guilty. I believe that people are almost always better than their neighbours think they are," said Dorothea.
Some of her intensest experience in the last 2 years had set her mind strongly in opposition to any unfavourable construction of others.
and for the first time she felt rather discontented with Mr. Fairbrother. She disliked this cautious weighing of consequences, instead of an ardent faith in efforts of justice and mercy, which would conquer by their emotional force. 2 days afterwards, he was dining at the manor with her uncle and the Chethams, and when the dessert was standing uneaten, the servants were out of the room, and Mr. Brooke was nodding in a nap, she returned to the subject with renewed vivacity. Mr. Lydgate would understand that if his friends hear a calumny about him, their first wish must be to justify. What do we live for if it is not to make life less difficult to each other? I cannot be indifferent to the troubles of a man who advised me in my trouble and attended me in my illness. Dorothea's tone and manner were not more energetic than they had been when she was at the head of her uncle's table nearly 3 years before, and her experience since had given her more right to express a decided opinion. But Sir James Chetham was no longer the diffident and acquiescent suitor. He was the anxious brother-in-law, with a devout admiration for his sister, but with a constant alarm lest she should fall under some new illusion almost as bad as marrying Casaubon. He smiled much less. When he said, "Exactly," it was more often an introduction to a dissentient opinion than in those submissive bachelor days. And Dorothea found to her surprise that she had to resolve not to be afraid of him, all the more because he was really her best friend. He disagreed with her now. "But, Dorothea," he said remonstrantly, "you can't undertake to manage a man's life for him in that way. Lydgate must know, at least he will soon come to know, how he stands. If he can clear himself, he will. He must act for himself." "I think his friends must wait till they find an opportunity," added Mr. Fairbrother. "It is possible. I have often felt so much weakness in myself that I can conceive even a man of honourable disposition, such as I have always believed Lydgate to be, succumbing to such a temptation as that of accepting money, which was offered more or less indirectly as a bribe, to ensure his silence about scandalous facts long gone by. I say I can conceive this, if he were under the pressure of hard circumstances, if he had been harassed, as I feel sure Lydgate has been. I would not believe anything worse of him except under stringent proof. But there is the terrible nemesis following on some errors, that it is always possible for those who like it to interpret them into a crime. There is no proof in favour of the man, outside his own consciousness and assertion." "Oh, how cruel!" said Dorothea, clasping her hands. "And would you not like to be the one person who believed in that man's innocence if the rest of the world belied him? Besides, there is a man's character beforehand to speak for him." "But, my dear Mrs. Casaubon," said Mr. Fairbrother, smiling gently at her ardour, "character is not cut in marble. It is not something solid and unalterable. It is something living and changing, and may become diseased, as our bodies do."
"Then it may be rescued and healed," said Dorothea. "I should not be afraid of asking Mr. Lydgate to tell me the truth, that I might help him. Why should I be afraid? Now that I am not to have the land, James, I might do as Mr. Bulstrode proposed, and take his place in providing for the hospital. And I have to consult Mr. Lydgate to know thoroughly what are the prospects of doing good by keeping up the present plans. There is the best opportunity in the world for me to ask for his confidence, and he would be able to tell me things which might make all the circumstances clear. Then we would all stand by him and bring him out of his trouble. People glorify all sorts of bravery, except the bravery they might show on behalf of their nearest neighbours." Dorothea's eyes had a moist brightness in them, and the changed tones of her voice roused her uncle, who began to listen.
"It is true that a woman may venture on some efforts of sympathy which would hardly succeed if we men undertook them," said Mr. Fairbrother, almost converted by Dorothea's ardour. "Surely a woman is bound to be cautious and listen to those who know the world better than she does," said Sir James, with his little frown. "Whatever you do in the end, Dorothea, you should really keep back at present and not volunteer any meddling with this Bulstrode business. We don't know yet what may turn up. You must agree with me," he ended, looking at Mr. Fairbrother. "I do think it would be better to wait," said the latter.
"Yes, yes, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, not quite knowing at what point the discussion had arrived, but coming up to it with a contribution which was generally appropriate. "It is easy to go too far, you know. You must not let your ideas run away with you. And as to being in a hurry to put money into schemes, it won't do, you know. Garth has drawn me in uncommonly with repairs, draining, that sort of thing. I'm uncommonly out of pocket with one thing or another. I must pull up. As for you, Chetham, you are spending a fortune on those oak fences round your demesne."
Dorothea, submitting uneasily to this discouragement, went with Celia into the library, which was her usual drawing-room.
"Now, Dodo, do listen to what James says," said Celia, "else you will be getting into a scrape. You always did, and you always will, when you set about doing as you please. And I think it is a mercy now, after all, that you have got James to think for you. He lets you have your plans, only he hinders you from being taken in. And that is the good of having a brother instead of a husband. A husband would not let you have your plans."
"As if I wanted a husband," said Dorothea. "I only want not to have my feelings checked at every turn."
Mrs. Casaubon was still undisciplined enough to burst into angry tears.
"Now, really, Dodo," said Celia, with rather a deeper guttural than usual, "you are contradictory. First one thing and then another. You used to submit to Mr. Casaubon quite shamefully. I think you would have given up ever coming to see me if he had asked you."
"Of course I submitted to him because it was my duty. It was my feeling for him," said Dorothea, looking through the prism of her tears.
"Then why can't you think it your duty to submit a little to what James wishes?" said Celia, with a sense of stringency in her argument. "Because he only wishes what is for your own good. And of course men know best about everything, except what women know better."
Dorothea laughed and forgot her tears.
"Well, I mean about babies and those things," explained Celia. "I should not give up to James when I knew he was wrong, as you used to do to Mr. Casaubon."
Chapter 73. When Lydgate had allayed Mrs. Bulstrode's anxiety by telling her that her husband had been seized with faintness at the meeting, but that he trusted to see him better and would call again the next day, unless she sent for him earlier, he went directly home, got on his horse, and rode 3 miles out of the town for the sake of being out of reach. He felt himself becoming violent and unreasonable, as if raging under the pain of stings. He was ready to curse the day on which he had come to Middlemarch. Everything that had happened to him there seemed a mere preparation for this hateful fatality, which had come as a blight on his honourable ambition, and must make even people who had only vulgar standards regard his reputation as irrevocably damaged. In such moments, a man can hardly escape being unloving. Lydgate thought of himself as the sufferer, and of others as the agents who had injured his lot. He had meant everything to turn out differently, and others had thrust themselves into his life and thwarted his purposes. His marriage seemed an unmitigated calamity, and he was afraid of going to Rosamond before he had vented himself in this solitary rage, lest the mere sight of her should exasperate him and make him behave unwarrantably. There are episodes in most men's lives in which their highest qualities can only cast a deterring shadow over the objects that fill their inward vision. Lydgate's tender-heartedness was present just then only as a dread lest he should offend against it, not as an emotion that swayed him to tenderness. For he was very miserable. Only those who know the supremacy of the intellectual life, the life which has a seed of ennobling thought and purpose within it, can understand the grief of one who falls from that serene activity into the absorbing, soul-wasting struggle with worldly annoyances. How was he to live on without vindicating himself among people who suspected him of baseness? How could he go silently away from Middlemarch as if he were retreating before a just condemnation? And yet, how was he to set about vindicating himself? For that scene at the meeting which he had just witnessed, although it had told him no particulars, had been enough to make his own situation thoroughly clear to him. Bulstrode had been in dread of scandalous disclosures on the part of Raffles. Lydgate could now construct all the probabilities of the case. He was afraid of some betrayal in my hearing. All he wanted was to bind me to him by a strong obligation. That was why he passed on a sudden from hardness to liberality. And he may have tampered with the patient. He may have disobeyed my orders. I fear he did. But whether he did or not, the world believes that he somehow or other poisoned the man and that I winked at the crime, if I didn't help in it. And yet, he may not be guilty of the last offence. And it is just possible that the change towards me may have been a genuine relenting, the effect of second thoughts, such as he alleged. What we call the just possible is sometimes true, and the thing we find it easier to believe is grossly false. In his last dealings with this man, Bulstrode may have kept his hands pure, in spite of my suspicion to the contrary. There was a benumbing cruelty in his position. Even if he renounced every other consideration than that of justifying himself, if he met shrugs, cold glances, and avoidance as an accusation, and made a public statement of all the facts as he knew them, who would be convinced? It would be playing the part of a fool to offer his own testimony on behalf of himself and say, "I did not take the money as a bribe." The circumstances would always be stronger than his assertion. And besides, to come forward and tell everything about himself must include declarations about Bulstrode, which would darken the suspicions of others against him. He must tell that he had not known of Raffles' existence when he first mentioned his pressing need of money to Bulstrode, and that he took the money innocently as a result of that communication, not knowing that a new motive for the loan might have arisen on his being called in to this man. And after all, the suspicion of Bulstrode's motives might be unjust. But then came the question whether he should have acted in precisely the same way if he had not taken the money. Certainly, if Raffles had continued alive and susceptible of further treatment when he arrived, and he had then imagined any disobedience to his orders on the part of Bulstrode, he would have made a strict inquiry. And if his conjecture had been verified, he would have thrown up the case, in spite of his recent heavy obligation. But if he had not received any money, if Bulstrode had never revoked his cold recommendation of bankruptcy, would he, Lydgate, have abstained from all inquiry even on finding the man dead? Would the shrinking from an insult to Bulstrode, would the dubiousness of all medical treatment and the argument that his own treatment would pass for the wrong with most members of his profession, have had just the same force or significance with him? That was the uneasy corner of Lydgate's consciousness while he was reviewing the facts and resisting all reproach. If he had been independent, this matter of a patient's treatment, and the distinct rule that he must do or see done that which he believed best for the life committed to him, would have been the point on which he would have been the sturdiest. As it was, he had rested in the consideration that disobedience to his orders, however it might have arisen, could not be considered a crime, that in the dominant opinion obedience to his orders was just as likely to be fatal, and that the affair was simply one of etiquette. Whereas again and again, in his time of freedom, he had denounced the perversion of pathological doubt into moral doubt, and had said, "The purest experiment in treatment may still be conscientious. My business is to take care of life, and to do the best I can think of for it. Science is properly more scrupulous than dogma. Dogma gives a charter to mistake, but the very breath of science is a contest with mistake, and must keep the conscience alive." Alas, the scientific conscience had got into the debasing company of money obligation and selfish respects. "Is there a medical man of them all in Middlemarch who would question himself as I do?" said poor Lydgate, with a renewed outburst of rebellion against the oppression of his lot. "And yet they will all feel warranted in making a wide space between me and them as if I were a leper. My practice and my reputation are utterly damned. I can see that. Even if I could be cleared by valid evidence, it would make little difference to the blessed world here. I have been set down as tainted and should be cheapened to them all the same." Already there had been abundant signs, which had hitherto puzzled him, that just when he had been paying off his debts and getting cheerfully on his feet, the townsmen were avoiding him or looking strangely at him. and in two instances it came to his knowledge that patients of his had called in another practitioner. The reasons were too plain now. The general blackballing had begun. No wonder that in Lydgate's energetic nature, the sense of a hopeless misconstruction easily turned into a dogged resistance. The scowl which occasionally showed itself on his square brow was not a meaningless accident. Already, when he was re-entering the town after that ride taken in the first hours of stinging pain, he was setting his mind on remaining in Middlemarch in spite of the worst that could be done against him. He would not retreat before calumny as if he submitted to it. He would face it to the utmost, and no act of his should show that he was afraid. It belonged to the generosity as well as defiant force of his nature that he resolved not to shrink from showing to the full his sense of obligation to Bulstrode. It was true that the association with this man had been fatal to him. True that if he had the £1,000 still in his hands with all his debts unpaid, he would have returned the money to Bulstrode and taken beggary, rather than the rescue which had been sullied with the suspicion of a bribe. For remember, he was one of the proudest among the sons of men. Nevertheless, he would not turn away from this crushed fellow mortal, whose aid he had used, and make a pitiful effort to get acquittal for himself by howling against another. "I shall do as I think right and explain to nobody. They will try to starve me out, but..." He was going on with an obstinate resolve. But he was getting near home, and the thought of Rosamond urged itself again into that chief place from which it had been thrust by the agonized struggles of wounded honour and pride. How would Rosamond take it all? Here was another weight of chain to drag, and poor Lydgate was in a bad mood for bearing her dumb mastery. He had no impulse to tell her the trouble which must soon be common to them both. He preferred waiting for the incidental disclosure, which events must soon bring about. Chapter 74. In Middlemarch, a wife could not long remain ignorant that the town held a bad opinion of her husband. No feminine intimate might carry her friendship so far as to make a plain statement to the wife of the unpleasant fact known or believed about her husband. But when a woman with her thoughts much at leisure got them suddenly employed on something grievously disadvantageous to her neighbours, various moral impulses were called into play, which tended to stimulate utterance. Candour was one. To be candid, in Middlemarch phraseology, meant to use an early opportunity of letting your friends know that you did not take a cheerful view of their capacity, their conduct, or their position. And a robust candour never waited to be asked for its opinion. Then again, there was the love of truth, a wide phrase, but meaning in this relation a lively objection to seeing a wife look happier than her husband's character warranted, or manifest too much satisfaction in her lot. The poor thing should have some hint given her that if she knew the truth, she would have less complacency in her bonnet and in light dishes for a supper party. Stronger than all, there was the regard for a friend's moral improvement, sometimes called her soul, which was likely to be benefited by remarks tending to gloom, uttered with the accompaniment of pensive staring at the furniture, and a manner implying that the speaker would not tell what was on her mind from regard to the feelings of her hearer. On the whole, one might say that an ardent charity was at work, setting the virtuous mind to make a neighbour unhappy for her good. There were hardly any wives in Middlemarch whose matrimonial misfortunes would in different ways be likely to call forth more of this moral activity than Rosamond and her aunt Bulstrode. Mrs. Bulstrode was not an object of dislike, and had never consciously injured any human being. Men had always thought her a handsome, comfortable woman, and had reckoned it among the signs of Bulstrode's hypocrisy that he had chosen a red-blooded Vincey instead of a ghastly and melancholy person suited to his low esteem for earthly pleasure. When the scandal about her husband was disclosed, they remarked of her, "Ah, poor woman, she's as honest as the day. She never suspected anything wrong in him, you may depend on it." Women who were intimate with her talked together much of poor Harriet, imagined what her feelings must be when she came to know everything, and conjectured how much she had already come to know. There was no spiteful disposition towards her. Rather, there was a busy benevolence, anxious to ascertain what it would be well for her to feel and do under the circumstances, which, of course, kept the imagination occupied with her character and history from the time when she was Harriet Vincey till now. With the review of Mrs. Bulstrode and her position, it was inevitable to associate Rosamond, whose prospects were under the same blight with her aunt's. Rosamond was more severely criticised and less pitied, though she too, as one of the good old Vincey family who had always been known in Middlemarch, was regarded as a victim to marriage with an interloper. The Vinceys had their weaknesses, but then they lay on the surface. There was never anything bad to be found out concerning them. Mrs. Bulstrode was vindicated from any resemblance to her husband. Harriet's faults were her own. "She has always been showy," said Mrs. Hackbutt, making tea for a small party, "though she has got into the way of putting her religion forward to conform to her husband. She has tried to hold her head up above Middlemarch by making it known that she invites clergymen and heaven knows who from Riverston and those places." "We can hardly blame her for that," said Mrs. Sprague, "because few of the best people in the town cared to associate with Bulstrode, and she must have somebody to sit down at her table." "Mr. Thesiger has always countenanced him," said Mrs. Hackbutt. "I think he must be sorry now."
"But he was never fond of him in his heart. That everyone knows," said Mrs. Toller. "Mr. Thesiger never goes into extremes. He keeps to the truth in what is evangelical. It is only clergymen like Mr. Tyke, who want to use dissenting hymn books and that low kind of religion, who ever found Bulstrode to their taste."
"I understand Mr. Tyke is in great distress about him," said Mrs. Hackbutt, "and well he may be. They say the Bulstrodes have half kept the Tyke family."
"And of course it is a discredit to his doctrines," said Mrs. Sprague, who was elderly and old-fashioned in her opinions. "People will not make a boast of being Methodistical in Middlemarch for a good while to come."
"I think we must not set down people's bad actions to their religion," said falcon-faced Mrs. Plimdale, who had been listening hitherto.
"Oh, my dear, we are forgetting," said Mrs. Sprague. "We ought not to be talking of this before you."
"I am sure I have no reason to be partial," said Mrs. Plimdale, colouring. "It's true Mr. Plimdale has always been on good terms with Mr. Bulstrode, and Harriet Vincey was my friend long before she married him. But I have always kept my own opinions and told her where she was wrong, poor thing. Still, in point of religion, I must say Mr. Bulstrode might have done what he has and worse, and yet have been a man of no religion. I don't say that there has not been a little too much of that. I like moderation myself, but truth is truth. The men tried at the assizes are not all over-religious, I suppose." "Well," said Mrs. Hackbutt, wheeling adroitly, "all I can say is that I think she ought to separate from him."
"I can't say that," said Mrs. Sprague. "She took him for better or worse, you know."
"But worse can never mean finding out that your husband is fit for Newgate," said Mrs. Hackbutt. "Fancy living with such a man. I should expect to be poisoned."
"Yes, I think myself it is an encouragement to crime if such men are to be taken care of and waited on by good wives," said Mrs. Tom Toller.
"And a good wife poor Harriet has been," said Mrs. Plimdale. "She thinks her husband the first of men. It's true, he has never denied her anything."
"Well, we shall see what she will do," said Mrs. Hackbutt.
"I suppose she knows nothing yet, poor creature. I do hope and trust I shall not see her, for I should be frightened to death lest I should say anything about her husband. Do you think any hint has reached her?"
"I should hardly think so," said Mrs. Tom Toller. "We hear that he is ill, and has never stirred out of the house since the meeting on Thursday. but she was with her girls at church yesterday, and they had new Tuscan bonnets. Her own had a feather in it. I have never seen that her religion made any difference in her dress.
She wears very neat patterns always, said Mrs. Plimdale, a little stung. And that feather, I know she got dyed a pale lavender on purpose to be consistent. I must say it of Harriet that she wishes to do right.
As to her knowing what has happened, it can't be kept from her long, said Mrs. Hagbert. The Vincys know, for Mr. Vincey was at the meeting. It will be a great blow to him. There is his daughter as well as his sister.
Yes, indeed, said Mrs. Sprague. Nobody supposes that Mr. Lydgate can go on holding up his head in Middlemarch. Things look so black about the £1,000 he took just at that man's death. It really makes one shudder.
Pride must have a fall, said Mrs. Hagbert.
I am not so sorry for Rosamond Vincey that was, as I am for her aunt, said Mrs. Plimdale. She needed a lesson.
I suppose the Bulstrodes will go and live abroad somewhere, said Mrs. Sprague. That is what is generally done when there is anything disgraceful in a family.
And a most dreadful blow it will be to Harriet, said Mrs. Plimdale. If ever a woman was crushed, she will be. I pity her from my heart. And with all her faults, few women are better. From a girl she had the neatest ways, and was always good-hearted and as open as the day. You might look into her drawers when you would, always the same. And so she has brought up Kate and Ellen. You may think how hard it will be for her to go among foreigners.
The doctor says that is what he should recommend the Lydgates to do, said Mrs. Sprague. He says Lydgate ought to have kept among the French.
That would suit her well enough, I dare say, said Mrs. Plimdale. There is that kind of lightness about her. But she got that from her mother. She never got it from her aunt Bulstrode, who always gave her good advice, and to my knowledge would rather have had her marry elsewhere.
Mrs. Plimdale was in a situation which caused her some complication of feeling. There had been not only her intimacy with Mrs. Bulstrode, but also a profitable business relation of the great Plimdale dyeing house with Mr. Bulstrode, which on the one hand would have inclined her to desire that the mildest view of his character should be the true one, but on the other made her the more afraid of seeming to palliate his culpability. Again, the late alliance of her family with the Tollers had brought her in connection with the best circle, which gratified her in every direction except in the inclination to those serious views which she believed to be the best in another sense. The sharp little woman's conscience was somewhat troubled in the adjustment of these opposing bests, and of her griefs and satisfactions under late events, which were likely to humble those who needed humbling, but also to fall heavily on her old friend, whose faults she would have preferred seeing on a background of prosperity. Poor Mrs. Bulstrode, meanwhile, had been no further shaken by the oncoming tread of calamity than in the busier stirring of that secret uneasiness which had always been present in her since the last visit of Raffles to the Shrubs. That the hateful man had come ill to Stone Court, and that her husband had chosen to remain there and watch over him, she allowed to be explained by the fact that Raffles had been employed and aided in earlier days, and that this made a tie of benevolence towards him in his degraded helplessness. And she had been, since then, innocently cheered by her husband's more hopeful speech about his own health and ability to continue his attention to business. The calm was disturbed when Lydgate had brought him home ill from the meeting, and in spite of comforting assurances during the next few days, she cried in private from the conviction that her husband was not suffering from bodily illness merely, but from something that afflicted his mind. He would not allow her to read to him, and scarcely to sit with him, alleging nervous susceptibility to sounds and movements. Yet she suspected that in shutting himself up in his private room, he wanted to be busy with his papers. Something, she felt sure, had happened. Perhaps it was some great loss of money, and she was kept in the dark. Not daring to question her husband, she said to Lydgate, on the fifth day after the meeting, when she had not left home except to go to church,
Mr. Lydgate, pray be open with me. I like to know the truth. Has anything happened to Mr. Bulstrode?
Some little nervous shock, said Lydgate evasively. He felt that it was not for him to make the painful revelation.
But what brought it on? Said Mrs. Bulstrode, looking directly at him with her large, dark eyes.
There is often something poisonous in the air of public rooms, said Lydgate. Strong men can stand it, but it tells on people in proportion to the delicacy of their systems. It is often impossible to account for the precise moment of an attack, or rather, to say why the strength gives way at a particular moment.
Mrs. Bulstrode was not satisfied with his answer. There remained in her the belief that some calamity had befallen her husband of which she was to be kept in ignorance, and it was in her nature strongly to object to such concealment. She begged leave for her daughters to sit with their father, and drove into the town to pay some visits, conjecturing that if anything were known to have gone wrong in Mr. Bulstrode's affairs, she should see or hear some sign of it. She called on Mrs. Thesiger, who was not at home, and then drove to Mrs. Hackbutt's on the other side of the churchyard. Mrs. Hackbutt saw her coming from an upstairs window, and remembering her former alarm lest she should meet Mrs. Bulstrode, felt almost bound in consistency to send word that she was not at home. But against that, there was a sudden strong desire within her for the excitement of an interview in which she was quite determined not to make the slightest allusion to what was in her mind. Hence, Mrs. Bulstrode was shown into the drawing-room, and Mrs. Hackbutt went to her with more tightness of lip and rubbing of her hands than was usually observable in her, these being precautions adopted against freedom of speech. She was resolved not to ask how Mr. Bulstrode was.
"I have not been anywhere except to church for nearly a week," said Mrs. Bulstrode, after a few introductory remarks. "But Mr. Bulstrode was taken so ill at the meeting on Thursday that I have not liked to leave the house."
Mrs. Hackbutt rubbed the back of one hand with the palm of the other held against her chest, and let her eyes ramble over the pattern on the rug.
"Was Mr. Hackbutt at the meeting?"
persevered Mrs. Bulstrode.
"Yes, he was," said Mrs. Hackbutt, with the same attitude. "The land is to be bought by subscription, I believe." "Let us hope that there will be no more cases of cholera to be buried in it," said Mrs. Bulstrode. "It is an awful visitation. But I always think Middlemarch a very healthy spot. I suppose it is being used to it from a child. But I never saw the town I should like to live at better, and especially our end."
"I am sure I should be glad that you always should live at Middlemarch, Mrs. Bulstrode," said Mrs. Hackbutt, with a slight sigh. "Still, we must learn to resign ourselves wherever our lot may be cast, though I am sure there will always be people in this town who will wish you well."
Mrs. Hackbutt longed to say, "If you take my advice, you will part from your husband," but it seemed clear to her that the poor woman knew nothing of the thunder ready to bolt on her head, and she herself could do no more than prepare her a little.
End of disc 23.